Content warning. This story contains scenes and scenarios which may be very disturbing to some listeners. Your discretion is strongly advised. Thank you, as always, for listening and supporting what I do. Now, let's delve into the dark together. Midday was full of flies, and Isaiah Hilliard came running from the gravel path that snaked way down to Sutton's pond. His hands were covered in pumpkin innards and red. Red blood. I'd never seen the boy so pale. He'd been off with Maud Tillerson's two boys and my brother's little Emma. They'd all been playing, skipping stones and sword fighting with tree limbs and carving up half a dozen pumpkins they'd liberated from Maud and Alvin's land two plots over. My brother Lon and his latest fiancée were in town shopping for wedding dresses at a bridal boutique that the town had no business having. A new addition, like so many, that had slowly made the once familiar town foreign. I'd left it behind me, but returned on occasion, because Lon would never leave. He was a poor farmer, but he dug in his roots and settled into the land all the same. For half a day, I'd keep busy swatting and shoeing and doing my best to mend the fence that kept the horses in. I hadn't planned on mending a child, too.
What happened, sir?
We were making jack-o'-lanterns, sir, the five of us, and something went wrong.
One of you got cut. Who's hurt?
The boy was sobbing and shaking away the sunny clots of pumpkin and seeds from his hand. The blood remained. The boy's eyes darted, searching for something. Frantic.
All of them.
Whose blood is that?
He winced.
All of them's.
Then the boy was heaving, quick breaths littered with spittle.
I think I killed him. I must have, but I don't know why.
Isaiah Hilliard was a small boy, so skinny you could count the knots of bone all the way down his back in the summer when he'd come in with the Tillersons and Emma, dripping dry from the pond. Roy Tillerson, the older of Maud's two boys, must have been twice Isaiah's size. Roy only had one wound to bleed from. A small slit just between the ribs, barely ragged from the teeth of the steak knife that made it. Paul Tillerson was brutalized. 19 holes dug into his sun-licked skin, and his throat was open wide when I found him. Isaiah did his best not to look at either one of the Tillersons. I couldn't blame him.
I needed his head for some reason, but the knife wasn't sharp enough.
Christ, boy. What about Emma? Where's she?
The boy crouched low, still pale and sweating in spite of the cool, wet air that wafted from the pond and the woods beyond. Then he pointed at the water and hid behind his skinny little knees.
She's in there, with the rest of them, praying.
The sheriff's department in Woodrow had three aging Crown Vics and a pickup truck that Sheriff Ryland had sold to the town when he bought a new one for himself. All but one was scattered around my brother Lon's driveway when Lon and Olivia finally came home. He left his phone charging in the kitchen, and Olivia's number was a mystery to me, so they hadn't heard. And Olivia was smiling as she stepped out of the car. It didn't last. Lon seemed cantankerous from the start.
Benny, what the hell happened here?
He asked.
You should come inside, Lon.
Where's Emma?
Come on in. Flies are vicious. You'll want a drink.
He sat at the dining room table, staring somewhere between the bottle of plantains he hadn't yet opened and his jittery knuckles. I told him what I knew. Two boys were dead, and Isaiah was being watched by one deputy or another, and Emma was missing. Sean Dixon, a church boy who didn't look like much of a cop at all, had drawn the short straw and went wading into the pond in his britches. He hadn't found Emma, and 4 feet from the water's edge, he'd lost his footing on the bottom. It was useless to search the water with your eyes. Sutton's pond was deep and black and freezing in October. Its floor slipped away quickly, carpeted with foot-sucking muck and hidden branches and 1,000 decaying leaves from the trees that overhung it. 3 properties bound to it. The Hewitt's piece was good for fishing, the Arborough's for tire swinging. One family's piece was only good for stories. The deaths of two boys at the hands of another would just be one more rag of mystery to float among the rest. Olivia wrinkled her face as I tried to tell a threadbare recounting of the boy's death. She must have been closer to Roy Tillerson's age than Lon's, and her childhood had been a soft one. I could see that much in the brightness of her eyes. Lon had always said she was in her 20s and left it at that. I didn't pry, didn't judge. The girl was bubbly and hopeful and light as dandelion fluff. Everything Emma's mother hadn't been. And I think Lon loved her, as much as he was capable of such a thing. She draped over his arm, sighing little consolations. Lon received her affection grimly. His first drink was his last at the table, a long swig pulled from the bottle. He didn't bother with the glass.
Well, I'm gonna get out there. You coming, Benny?
I stood.
Yeah.
Good. Olivia, baby, you stay here. You don't want to see whatever's down there, all right?
She gave Lon a half-smile, an awkward, gracious one.
Okay. And, Lon, if you find her and she's all right, but when you do, I mean, you tell her about the costume, okay? She'll like it.
Will do.
It was a 10-minute walk down to the pond. Lon was silent for the first 5. He walked deliberately, each step concussing the grounds below, pushing it away more than pushing him ahead. Emma was his only child, the only one that God had let him keep. 2 others had been stillborn. His wife, Emma's mother, had covered herself in so much of the grief from their losses that I'm not sure Lon had ever properly grieved himself. As we walked without speaking, I could see the apprehension of another fresh tragedy lapping at him. His mouth was swallowed by the beard he'd had for years, but his brow said plenty for the rest of him. Worry. A mean scowl. Worry again. Finally, he asked,
"You think the Hilliard boy killed my Emma?"
"I don't know. Hell, I hope not." Another quiet minute, walking.
"You could have stopped him."
"I wasn't there, huh?"
"Maybe you should have been."
I don't know why I argued, but I did.
Yeah, you want to blame me? Fine, then you could tell me how many times Mama or Pops went with us down to Sutton's when we were Emma's age. How often do you go with her now?"
"This ain't about me."
"You're right, it's about her. Now stop jumping down my damn throat about it, and think about how to find her."
"Yeah."
"Then before you get any ideas, don't you touch the Hilliard boy when we get down there."
"If he killed my Emma..."
"We don't know he did, all right? She might be hiding, on a run when whatever happened, happened."
He swallowed whatever else he'd been ready to say after that, and together, quietly, we trod a path we both had known so well for so long. The biggest trees remained the same, the pitch of the land, the curves and the crunch of the gravel underfoot. But for nearly 40 years, this walk had been an innocent one, and whatever stories drifted through the trees and stalked along the edges of that path had just been stories. Our father had told us most of them. One was about a revival church that took a liking to that pond for baptisms of wayward sinners looking for the light of God. He spoke of their clothes, white as baby's teeth against the gray trunks of the trees and the brush between. Mama clicked her tongue when Pop smirked and whispered of lithe, pretty bodies returned from the pond, free of woe and modesty, their baptismal shifts soaked down to peaking flesh. I think he gave us that prurient detail to sweeten the rest of the story.
It was a summer day some 2 years after the congregation Emmanuel arrived in Woodrow.
Pop's smile faded when he began that part. All his worst stories happened on nice days full of sun and smiles. He said he had walked down to the pond in the heat of the afternoon, and there, in that still black water that had washed away so much sin, he found the congregation. They were all clad in salvation white, he said, all floating, drowned. There were other stories too, but I think that one was truer than most. He spoke of swimming in to drag each body out, and his voice cracked a bit as he did. It never did that. If we found Emma alive, she'd known the truth of her story, and the blood would be real, and a part of me hated Isaiah Hilliard for that. She was a sweet kid, too sweet for her bootleather father, and too sweet for slit throats. The flies hung like an omen, crowding the air as we finally met the scene. Isaiah was in handcuffs. They looked too big on his thin wrists. His father would be at home, I imagined, too drunk tired to answer the phone. His mother worked in town. She'd take it bad, and her husband would slip into another bottle. Sheriff Ryland gave Lon a stiff handshake, moved the sweat around the back of his thick neck with his thick hand, cleared his throat.
Your girl.
Is she dead?
Lon asked briskly.
The boy seems to think so, but...
That right, Hilliard?
Lon barely raised his voice, but I could hear the char in it. Both of them shook, blood-eyed father and blood-handed child. The boy didn't answer. His father had probably done them both a favor. The sheriff seemed annoyed, but he seemed to think he put a knife in Roy. Tillerson's hard without catching so much as a busted lip. Clearly someone did, but Isaiah Hilliard... Lon gave the boy an appraising glance, then looked over to Big Roy, who lay flat on his back, arms splayed out like some blood-besotted vagabond sleeping one off. A deputy, Faraday, took photographs of Paul. Flies peppered his body. Shiftless apostles gathered round the communion of a corpse that had been a giggling child when the day was young. Faraday took breaks often, stealing his stomach, I suppose. Two others, Sean Dixon and a greenhorn, were off beating the branches somewhere. They called Emma's name sporadically. Lon winced a little each time they did. Sheriff Ryland stared down at the pond, sucking at his mustache as red leaves fell and drifted and settled onto its surface.
We might have to drain it. Dixon said there's no chance of finding nothing down there.
Fine, Lon said, squinting into the trees. The Yarlboroughs will let you. Ed Howitt's gonna put up a fight. He likes to fish, and he's a stubborn ass.
I'll get him in line, if it was Ed's granddaughter.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you, Sheriff.
Lon's eyes returned to Isaiah for a long while, then sniffed. Where are the pumpkins? Sheriff Ryland looked confused at the question. I hadn't noticed. The two dead boys had stolen away most of my attention, but Lon was right. They had gotten pumpkins from the Tillersons. Isaiah's hands had been covered in their leavings, and they weren't anywhere. I finally decided I could contribute something useful.
It was said they were carving jack-o'-lanterns when he first came up. All four.
Five. He had said the five of us, and I'd missed that, too. Benny.
Hell, I think there was someone else here. The boy said there were five of them carving pumpkins. Five. Him, the Tillersons, Emma, and...
Lon's neck grew taut. He had blamed me for not watching his daughter. I reckoned he'd blame me for this oversight, too. But a second later, the only thing I could see in his eyes was fear.
There were five of you, Hilliard? Who else is with you?
The boy looked sickly, tearful. Then he was retching onto the ground beside him. Lon knew better than to press his luck just then. Had Ryland and the other deputies not been there, he might have beat an answer out of him. But for the time being, the sheriff seemed content to let the boy retch in peace. It was the next best thing.
Benny, you sure? He said five.
Much as I can be.
There aren't any other kids around, Ryland. Roy's 12, for Christ's sake, playing with Emma and Isaiah.
There was a silent exchange between Lon and Sheriff Ryland. Something cryptic and fitful.
What else did he tell you, Benny?
Lon seemed desperate instead of annoyed. I got the feeling that Hillier's words, his confession, my uneasy memory, were just barely kindling something vital. I tried to remember.
He said that Emma was praying with them, I think. The boy wasn't in his right mind.
Lon paled. Sheriff Rylan shook his head. It's a legend, Lon. That's all. Something to scare kids.
It was my daddy's legend. His before him.
That don't make it true. It just makes it old.
Yeah.
Lon brushed away dirt on his pants that wasn't there, straightened his slumping shoulders. I'm gonna make Ed Hewitt understand things myself. A pump and an excavator ought to do it. I'll drive out to the city and get the pump. Dixon's brother does construction. You all can figure it out. We're draining this fucking hole tomorrow morning. Lon tore away up the hill. Sheriff Ryland's eyes returned to the pond, the wide black water of it. It had been years since I'd looked at that still surface and felt dread. But I did then. The flies were heavy, buzzing away the bird's song and the rustle of the breeze, and every red leaf that had fallen since I'd arrived was missing, consumed by that sin-fed dark below. I caught a shiver, staring with him, and I almost convinced myself it was nothing but the breeze. Olivia was poured over the living room sofa when I got back to the house, the way a cat might be in a patch of sun. The television prattled. She pecked away at her phone, then perked up when she heard the door.
You find it?
Nah, they're still looking.
I did my best to shake away the fresh memory of my brother's sallow face, tried to smile for her sake.
I'm sure they'll find it.
She nodded.
Where's Lon?
He didn't come to say goodbye?
No. He went somewhere?
Drove to the city to get to pick something up.
Oh, right. Something.
She'd find out soon enough what Lon had planned. She may even be smart enough to guess why a man would go through the trouble of draining a pond. I didn't want to heap anything on her before I needed to, and Lon hadn't told me what had spooked him. Neither had Ryland when I asked. So, I made small talk.
What are you watching? Anything good?
Oh, she chuckled. The background noise. Things were too quiet. This house creaks, Halloween's coming, everything else out there.
There's mice in the walls and squirrels in the attic.
She seems to know as much. Didn't take it as a revelation. Our childhood home was old. A 19th century farmhouse with broad, tarred beams and rough stones the color of sand and a dull tin roof. It was sturdy in a way that boasted frailty at a glance. Time had shifted its heavy bones and made everything slightly crooked. Our father and his had built a slouching porch that wrapped halfway around the place. They'd kept up the barn and let the old grain silo go to rust. Mama had made it all pretty. She kept it clean and sewed little glass bottles of wild flowers around. Emma's mother had done the same between the fits of melancholy and madness. Now Olivia ornamented the place with herself, and a foolhardy part of me felt like she was enough. She had laid out two Halloween costumes on the dining table, a small, furry black cat onesie, a tattered dress, a pointed hat. It was a sweet and somber thing to see, and despite myself, I thought of that dress hugging the curve of Olivia's hip. Then I conjured the image of Paul Tillerson to chase it away.
You want a beer, Benny?
Olivia smiled.
Yeah. Thanks.
You think you can manage more words than your brother? Or is Tactoon something genetic?
I can talk. What do you want to talk about?
You?
I'm fine. I don't need you trying to be my therapist, Olivia.
She scoffed, giggling.
Me? No. What do you think the beer is for? I just figure you for better conversation than the mice in the walls and the squirrels in the attic.
I smiled. A real smile. Perhaps the first I'd had all day. Afterwards, I drank a beer, another, and another. Everything crept into the sky in subtle strides, and Sheriff Ryland's boy called it a night. He'd broken the news to Maud and Alvin Tillerson. He didn't say how the conversation had gone, and I was thankful for that. He also told me to stay put and keep the light on. The night wasn't meant to be too cold, and if Emma was hiding somewhere, she'd want a familiar face to come back to. Ryland's tone was dead flat when he said that, his mouth a furtive wriggle beneath his mustache. He didn't think Emma was coming back, and I didn't want to think about what that had to do with praying in the pond and my brother's fear. There were secrets that hadn't followed me out of Woodrow, stories for firstborn sons that Pops had kept away from me. I was fine with that, and the cooler was full, and I was going to get too drunk for death to intrude. By 10, I had done just that. By midnight, I was loopy, and Olivia was laughing, and the both of us were singing duets by Carter and Cash. Drunken Olivia was nothing like the few impressions I'd gotten from my 2 or 3 visits back home. Then she seemed timid and dull, a pretty accessory to a rough man in an old place. Now she was clever and loud, ribbing me for my rustic childhood and bemoaning the stillness of Woodrow and dancing awful close. I led her, leading as she shared her heat. Beer turns to bourbon, and Olivia stopped pulling the strap of her dress back onto her shoulder, and the drunken shouts turned to drunken whispers, and Olivia didn't blush as all of her dress slid onto the floor.
This is probably a bad idea.
Probably.
She searched my eyes, earnest, then giddy, and back again. I pulled from the bottle. She licked the bourbon from my tongue, and I did something foolish and essential. I kissed her back, yanked the last of her clothes, felt her need, and gave her mine. We fell into that heady inertia of bare flesh and self-entitled deliverance, a shared secret gathered and kept in grasping fingers and flexing hips. And we fell out of it just as quickly. Olivia's moan slipped free of a bitten cushion, and the doorbell rang. We tensed together.
Oh, fuck. Lon.
The notion was a jarring one, sobering. But Lon wouldn't have rung his own doorbell.
Nah, he's got a key. Emma.
It was a happy moment at the worst time. Olivia found the blush that the bourbon had stolen away. She gathered up her clothes, made for the bedroom. I could answer the door in less than her, without anyone asking questions. I pulled my pants on, hurried.
Emma, I'll be right. Trick or treat.
The voice threw me off. Not Emma's or Lon's. A man whose voice I didn't know. I went to the door hesitantly, opened it slowly. It was 2 days before Halloween, and it was nearly 2 in the morning. I felt the wrongness of it all, but perhaps emboldened by the whiskey or the sweat, I stepped out beyond the threshold. The night air was cool, utterly silent, and a man sat on the bottom step of the stairs that climbed from the driveway to the porch. He was wearing a rumpled suit, facing away, rocking ever so slightly back and forth. A misplaced drunkard, I reckoned.
Can I help you?
He rocked a little more vigorously. He didn't answer.
Hey, buddy, it's late and you're on private property. Why don't you get on home?
Still silent, he laid his hands on the step above him and lifted himself back onto it. He didn't turn around.
Hey, listen, you're gonna leave now, or I'll...
Another step, further up the stairs. Closer to me. He continued rocking, nodding his head, skittering his fingers across the next step up. I balled up a fist, took a step onto the porch, and whatever uneasy thoughts I was trying to subdue were swallowed by a sudden buzz of flies. Then, they were everywhere. The man bumped up another step. The flies coursed around me in erratic currents. I coughed and gagged as flies found my open mouth, my throat, my ears and nostrils. Another step. Bump. Skitter. Nod. 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 The flies began to bite. Sharp stings. Tiny. Many. They crawled across my feet, up my pant legs, biting, buzzing. Another step. Bump. Closer still. The man's frantic rocking became an excited heave, and beneath the buzz, I could hear his teeth. I hiss with every breath he drew. He was one step from the porch. The flies were crowding in around my eyelids, testing new ways into my head. Their multitudes had made me feeble, and the man's fingers skittered once more, and I stumbled backwards and into the house, swatting and shaking away the tickle of little legs. When I slammed the door, the buzzing ceased, and I was thrown into silence again. The flies rained down onto the floor. and all was still. They didn't move after, didn't crawl away or fidget or take back to the air. They were dead, I realized. All of them. Hundreds of flies, a still frame of television static strewn across the whitewashed boards underfoot. I was shaking when Olivia returns to the living room, counting the scores of welts that had arisen across my skin.
Oh my God, what happened?
What could I tell her? It didn't matter. The flies. There was a man out there who...
Him?
She pointed. Then I shot around. The curtains were drawn across the front of the house. Thin, white lines. Enough to obscure. They didn't hide the silhouette of a man pacing the porch, nodding a little more as he stopped to linger at each window. This time, when I shivered, I knew damn well it wasn't the breeze.
Stay away from the windows, Olivia. And whatever you do, do not open that door.
He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen. The word woke me. My word. And the sun lashed against the bare windows of a room that had been mine as a child. I cursed the morning for coming so quickly. Whatever time it was too early for my thrumming head, the blood knocking against my skull. I heard him in that rhythm, goading us to join him in the flies. Olivia had grumbled from her room. She had seen the fear in me, I'm sure, but she didn't know what lingered just outside the door. I did. I had the cowardice of wisdom, and she was brave and foolish, knowing only the shadow of fear. But she stayed put, like I'd asked. She was still sleeping when I rose. Lon was in the kitchen when I found my way down, wearing the clothes he'd worn the day before. Our father's old Colt revolver dangled from his hand, and I hovered in the doorway. It was an uncertain sight.
Lon?
Huh?
A pistol?
He didn't look at me. As much as I wanted to avoid his eye after what I'd done, I didn't know what to make of that. He stared blankly at Emma's mother's hutch opposite the sink. Inside it were three generations of wedding china, chipped and faded, cleaned and coddled, barely used, strata of happiness and woe. He sighed. You ever wonder what it is that makes a person the person you know? The question seemed dangerous, but he didn't wait for an answer. Blood and bones and everything else you see in someone. A corpse has all that. But there's something missing in the face of death, isn't there? They never looked like the person they were. Lon did his musing in his head, if he did any at all. He was no philosopher.
You okay, Lon?
Maybe it's the soul that fills in the rest. Something that leaves us when we sleep or die or lose ourselves looking at something pretty too long. Maybe your soul, the one that belongs to you, is what comes back. But maybe not. He squeezed his fingers around the grip of the pistol, idly thumbing at the hammer. Didn't acknowledge me. His stare seems tethered to the hutch, to something hard and distant and hidden amongst its years of dust. They're digging a trench out there, and then they'll start pumping the pond away. Such old water there. He didn't so much as glance at me, as abruptly he staggered away and out of the kitchen. I watched him warily, heard him whispering as he neared the front door. I shouldn't have let you back. I knew better. I knew. Then, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. The prayer had woven through my dreams, its meaning disfigured into something predatory. Now he spoke the words and stole out of the house. He didn't close the door behind him. Olivia came down not long after. We didn't speak. We drank our coffees and danced around one another, glancing and retreating gazes. We'd been hasty and stupid, but we'd been drunk too. And I kept that like a prayer to soothe away my guilt. For half the day, They ran a rust-licked blue diesel generator and moved Sutton's pond into a nearby ravine. Lon stayed out, staring at the slowly shrinking edge, cradling his pistol in his lap as those six pieces of deliverance hid away in its cylinder. The greenhorn deputy walked the woods. He called Emma's name as he had the day before, but this time with a bullhorn. The silence between his efforts grew, each filled with more futility and doubt than the last. The sheriff was busy being the sheriff. He dropped by in the morning the way a nurse might check a sedated patient. Around noon, he returned with two hunting dogs he'd borrowed from someone. They weren't made for finding little girls, but they nosed around the brush, and Sean Dixon minded them as they trotted out of sight. The pall of the whole operation was too much to stomach for long. I walked the gravel trail back and forth between the house and the pond a dozen times. It felt like penance. Seeing Lon and his comfort pistol and his slowly gulping pump. Seeing Olivia, who parted her lips and swallowed her words for me. Seeing the horses while I tried to mend my brother's fence. Emma's mother had been the one who kept horses. She had been a competition rider once, and then she had been broken by her own mind. An affliction that my brother couldn't fix with hard glances and more whiskey. She got worse, and Lon kept it all to himself, and on a warm day, when the wild strawberries were half-red, he found her dangling from a rope in the woods. For all I knew, the bough she'd hanged herself from still reached over Sutton's pond, silently remembering the weight of her. Her horses gathered in a conspiratorial huddle on the far side of the field as I wedged a fence rail into place. Two spry chestnut mares and one ancient piebald stallion. Their three heads hung together, one rising every now and then to shake out a huff before returning to the ground below. The sights unsettled me for a reason I couldn't place. I worked more quickly, finished near enough by evening as the greenhorn deputy came sauntering up the path from the pond.
"There's something in the water, Benny."
He dragged his feet, slouching as he came to a stop.
"Emma?"
I asked, before thinking if I would really want the answer. He shook his head, coughed, eyed a passing wisp of flies.
"I don't know,"
the greenhorn answered.
"Just something's all I know. The sheriff wants you to see."
He beckoned, and I followed. This time, the walk was different. The shadow of the trees obscured more of the underbrush as the sun peered out from behind their trunks. The branches seemed to lean a little more. The path seemed narrower, more crooked underfoot, and the pond ahead seemed perpetually to hide just beyond the next bend. The deputy lent me a flashlight as we trudged on. I thanked him and made small talk with him to keep from thinking about flies and fiancés. Greenhorn's name was Malcolm, a nervous talker and a pointless one, but he filled the air and didn't mind my half-hearted answers. Beyond this name, I didn't remember a word of detail. I followed because I was supposed to, but my stomach felt hollow, my legs tired, and as the clearing around the pond came into view, all I wanted to do was turn around and leave. The pump's generator shook, rattling a loose fitting that had been sound earlier in the day. It belched exhaust. My flashlight's narrow beam scattered occasionally on the milk-gray plumes. Ahead, where the black water of the pond had once stood, there was a hollow carved into the forest floor. The land sloped steeply into deep darkness, shining with wet rot. Lon's project had been successful, but Lon wasn't there. The sheriff wasn't there. Sean Dixon, the hounds, all gone. Something wasn't right. I turned.
"Hey, Malcolm, where'd they..."
The drone of Deputy Greenhorn's chatter had become so rote in the 10 minutes we'd walked that I hadn't noticed him go silent. He'd lagged behind me. Now he, too, was missing. And I was alone. And everything felt wrong.
"There's something in the water."
In his absence, Malcolm's words rose uneasily to my mind. I called his name, and my voice sunk beneath the fitful wheezes and gurgles of the generator. Without it, there would have been silence. I knew that. but the ungainly effort of the piece of machinery was perhaps just as troubling.
Malcolm, anyone here? Lord, Riley.
Nothing. I stood for a moment, panning my flashlight over the trees. The sun had gone, its dull illumination smothered by the masses of leaves around. I didn't want to stay. I felt the sickly nudge of dread. But my flashlight found the hollow at last, lingered, traced the pocketed muck and gray branches that clung to its slopes. What water remained was now 10 feet below. And as I found it, my light began to shudder.
There's something.
Isaiah Hilliard had said that Emma was praying in the pond. Malcolm's something was an even file of benches. Pews, still submerged by shallow water. I didn't see Emma. I saw them. A dozen pale faces staring back through the inch of water that covered them. All open-eyed and deathly still. I froze, trying not to see what I was seeing. Trying to make sense of the face in the front row.
Malcolm's. I turned, stumbled back up the path. And as the motor grew quiet behind me, and my light shook 100 shadows into the trees, I heard the din of flies around. Swelling, buzzing, riotous. But I didn't see a single one. Then, another sound stymied my escape. Through the swarm, I could hear the wet suction of footsteps behind. Something trudging the long collected grime of Sutton's pond. I calmed my flashlight from its erratic hiccups and turned to look. Aiming the beam to the surface of the crevice where the pond had been. A man, a misplaced drunkard from 2 nights before, perhaps, was rising from the pit. His head nodding so fiercely, his chest heaved with it. A second after the light touched him, he gave a final heave and froze, holding the position. As I stared and wished desperately for one of the rounds in Lon's cult. The man in the suit reared back slowly, in an embrace aimed at the heavens. With hollow eyes and an open mouth, the flies shrieked. Thousands, millions. The eruption spilled from every orifice in his face. A black, writhing cloud that billowed out like sentient gas. Coalescing tendrils that drifted and wound and aimed for me.
No.
I remember turning, screaming. The flies screamed with me as my ankles caught, and the world slowed as I hurtled towards it, headfirst. I woke to the wheeze of the chugging motor, the squeal of a smoldering belt accompanied by the dry, gurgling suck of cavitation. That pump was breathing itself into oblivion, the smoke heavy and thick in the air. My eyes found daylight, and as I sat, I found the pond. I stared into the drained crater, my mind's recollection still grasping even as I gawked from the weeds. Flies swarmed above the pit of Sutton's pond like vultures. Their menacing hum vibrating the air and my skin alike. The sun was beating, my head throbbed, and I was alone. That sticky feeling of blood on the back of my head led me to the rock jutting from the dirt, and the flies buzzed around it happily. So many fucking flies. Near my feet was the hose from the pump. Tripping over it must have brought it back to life, making it slave away until there was nothing left. The pond. I could see the crevice now. The dip of the earth that led to the deepest part of Sutton's pond. Buried within my brain, I felt the squirm of a memory. As the imagery of the pews fought for my attention, my stomach fought to keep down its contents. My head throbbed with every dry heave, and as I heard the splash of purchase at my feet, the pump mocked me in reverse. When I collected myself and looked at the pond once more, it felt like the world had stopped spinning. In the uncanny sight, I thought of Emma, and my feet started to move on their own. I made my way back towards the pond under the glaring sun. My legs shook like a newborn calf's, and my skull felt too heavy, but I had to see.
I needed to see. The pump wailed, and the hose shook with every chug, but it kept going, kept desperately inhaling at the other end. It sounded like it was trying to breathe through clay. I wished I could shut the damn thing off, but I only had the energy to blink away the flies and shamble through muck. By the time I had reached the crevice, I felt like I arrived too fast, and as my boots poked over the ledge of the sentiment, as I had no choice but to look into the pit below. At the bottom of Sutton's Pond, there were no children, no pews, only a pair of hunting dogs and a hungry pump. I didn't need to see the hose's end to understand the damage. I only knew that at some point, the pump had eaten through plenty of bone and fur before it found its way into the dog's throat and had a smoother time disemboweling, which it had done until the pond was devoid of liquid completely. The hose continued to gasp against the deflating corpse, desperately trying to breathe through muscles and dry blood vessels. The other hounds made even less sense. Whereas the first had been mutilated by the pump itself, this one looked like someone had wrung it, like a towel. The longer I looked at the damage, the less it seemed physically possible. I tore away from the brutality, my mind churning thoughts of two steep walls and twisted limbs and trying to find a shred of rationale. But Sean Dixon had been leading the dogs, and the pond still held water. That's right. Sean Dixon. Ryland. Lorne.
Lorne.
I left the dampened murk behind me, shouting until I hit gravel. The flies thinned, and everything else felt like a dream. It would be all right. I would find Lorne, and he would have Emma, Olivia, and I would pretend it was a dream, and we'd bury dogs instead of another child. The gravel path leading back home spun before me on a loom as I worked my way back to the house. The aching in the back of my skull bloomed inside my head. Each hurried step coaxed along by a fantasy of a happy ending. Everything would be okay. We'd patch things together and ignore and think of tire swings and fishing, and things would return to normal, just as they had when I stepped foot back onto this cursed property. Old legends would die old, and Emma would grow to tell her own stories, and happy feet would kick, and laughter would replace the dry gurgling of the hose as it vacuumed away the hound's facial structure. Just when I think the trail would never end, there's something in the road that draws my attention. At first, I thought of a melon, but when I saw the red spot, I realized it's Lorne.
Lorne,
I don't know why I speak to him. The severed head was laying on its side, the face petrified in an eternal grimace of pain. My father's Colt was in his mouth, still positioned where it had been when it blew out the back of his skull. The incision that separated him from his body was far from clean. It almost looked like the muscle had been torn away. The flies crowding in his eyes scattered when I pulled the gun free. And as the barrel clacked off of his teeth, I started to cry.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
The apology felt guilty, and I didn't even have the courage to say it out loud. I thought of Emma, and as I opened the sticky cylinder on the revolver, I thought of Olivia. 4 rounds had been spent, and I felt nervous thinking of the other 3 unaccounted rounds. The house was sobering in the sunlight. The flies lingered above it like a cloud, buzzing so hard I could feel it rattling my teeth. Gravel crunched under my boots, and the Colt was still dripping. The Crown Vics were still in the driveway. Some of the doors were opened, but none of them were running. The cavalry had returned and never left. I found Ryland hunched against his trunk, his waders soaked from the mess that was still leaking from his face. 1 shell had taken the jaw clean off, and another hit him square in the chest, The culprit was found not far from him in the form of Sean Dixon, the shotgun still clutched in his hands, the pump pulled mid-rack. He must have been readying another shell when the taser had been forced down his throat. I could hear the faint clicking of the battery's final throes as it charred him from the inside. Nobody had bothered to reach for a radio. I considered reaching for one, but the shape near the barn stopped me. One of the chestnut mares had laid down in front of it, on its side, flat. I left the smell of death behind, keeping my eyes on the barn as I walked up to it. A miasma of flies was spilling from one of the large doors, and I could see someone moving on the inside. Something had burrowed into the ribcage of the mare and left it hollow, gnarled bones leaving shadows over fly-flecked anatomy. The horse looked up at me with a lifeless eye, and I saw an extra socket in its forehead, bored by a 45. I hoped that it was there before the other damage began. 2. Inside the barn, someone was humming a tune. Someone little. When my shadow stretched from the doorway of the barn, Isaiah Hilliard didn't turn to look. His hands kept working in front of him, buried up to his elbows in the piebald stallion near the work table. The boy should have been in a cell somewhere, or with his mother. Not here. Several tools were missing from the corkboard, some of them bloodied and collecting straw at his sides. Sitting on the bench's surface was a single jack-o'-lantern, its crudely cut teeth covered in gore. More buzzing.
Hilliard?
My voice was a dry whisper. The boy paused for a moment before returning to work.
He said he'd hide him, but I didn't think it'd be in here. I hope you don't mind. I had to borrow some tools. Got one out already. I'll clean them when I'm done.
Who hit him?
I asked, closing the distance slowly. The straw started to squish under my feet, and I peeked over the stables to see the source. The other chestnut mare was nestled in its stall, its head removed impossibly. The separation was barbarically similar to Lon's. I pushed it away from my mind and walked to the boy, who was ignoring the question.
I was really hoping they'd find her, but praying down there. I'm sorry they didn't.
Hilliard withdrew a hand, and a bundle of organs I didn't care to identify plopped onto the floor. I looked at the dried tears of the indifferent piebald, clear from the ones long gone, and red from the one fired into it. Just like the other mare before it. The gun shook in my hand.
3. I cleared my throat. What happened, Hilliard? Why?
Emma's dad didn't believe me. It wasn't my fault. Nobody's, really. I suppose it don't matter now. Here we go.
There was a sudden gush, and Hilliard's hands came free. Tools clattered on the floor, and there was a series of squelches before Hilliard pulled free of the horse, his scrawny arms wrapped around his prize. He stretched when he stood, before hobbling over to the bench and heaving something on top of it. A second pumpkin smiled in the sunlight, the toothy grin still dripping.
Anyway,
Hilliard said, scooping up the tools.
You just missed him. He went inside not long ago. Might still be there.
Who? Tell me, boy. Please.
I grabbed Hilliard and spun him around, nearly shaking him. He felt so small, and when I looked into his eyes, a knot formed in the back of my throat. One eye deep black as the pond, the other gone. The path of the bullet had taken nearly half of his face with it. 4.
And the man with the flies that likes the horses, I told him I was sorry. He said it didn't matter. He didn't seem too keen on talking to me anyway. I was more worried about the girl in the house.
What girl?
The pretty one.
Olivia.
I tore away from Hilliard and left him in the barn, swatting flies and refusing to look back as he called after me.
Oh, hey, mister. A happy Halloween.
Lon said madness had claimed his wife. They had been happy and homey, and the term madness didn't make sense nor seem possible at the time. Even when I left her bedridden and vacant, I was with Lon in the inability to fathom it. Having to watch her waste away until the only strength she had left was for a 10-minute walk and a knot. She had been passionate about riding and stables and having kids, something that all faded away when she finally attained her perfect life. I don't know why the madness began, or why we never bothered to ask, but as the flies buzzed and my brain boiled and I stood in the doorway of the house, I understood it. The madness. Lon's body was sprawled on the couch, his neck stump coagulating where I had rested my head the night prior. Something seemed to unwind in my head, and I found myself no longer questioning the things I saw. Like why his hands had been removed as well, or why there was a set of dismembered hooves on the coffee table. The only thing that seemed to matter was...
Olivia...
My voice echoed like a cry for help. I burst into the kitchen, squeezing the gun so hard my fingers ached. I looked for her smiling face in the flow of her dress, and found nothing but silence and the bottle of Blanton's from the night before. Olivia had cleaned our glasses, but the memories of our sin clung to my mind. Another nail in the coffin of misery this house had become. I wanted to leave and never return. To forget about ponds and horses and pumpkins. Upstairs, something moved. Something heavy.
Olivia!
I called louder. The movement stopped. The flies buzzed, my skin scrawled, and my thumb pulled the hammer back on the gun. Another creak. The whine of ceiling joists. The master bedroom. I took the stairs. I'd just have to grab her. She'd be there, and we wouldn't have time to pack. Probably take Lon's truck. The bedroom doorway was dark. Something was in there, chewing.
Olivia?
I whispered. The hallway was long. It felt so far away. I crept down the hall, holding the revolver in front of me. The barrel shook. My finger twitched on the trigger. The flies buzzed. Through slivers of sunlight, I saw Olivia splayed on the bed. The horse monstrosity hunched over her, looked at me like one would seeing an ant scurrying over their shoe. Its jaw worked slowly, lazily, and long incisors turned beauty into paste before a long and egregious swallow. It adjusted its weight and leaned back, almost as if it wanted me to see. Her dress had been hiked up, and what had once been a slender stomach was reduced to a gaping cavity. The thing had eaten all the way to her spine and down, rooting through until it stopped at her pelvic floor, her underwear still left hanging on her hips. It glared at me within the darkness, void-like orbs glinting so softly. Predatory. Flies buzzed at its ears, and they twitched as it watched expectantly. I hadn't disturbed its meal. It was waiting for me. Olivia had passed looking out the window. A once devious smile left frozen in agony. Amidst falling tears, the gun shook in my hands, the dull metal feeling useless under the gaze of the monster. My finger twitched against the trigger, wanting desperately to pull it, to pull the gun on myself. Unable to do either. It wasn't finished yet. I stared at Olivia in anguish, and the creature groaned as it leaned over. Dried tears and dead eyes disappeared as its massive teeth closed around both temples, lifting her up with its mouth staring at me as it bit down. My view of the destruction started to blur as I sobbed, a tortured wail that rang all the way to Sutton's Pond. The monster watched as the gun slipped from my fingers, and it didn't as much as blink when it went off. The gun smoked on the floor as I screamed with the flies, and the monster worked its jaw as Olivia vanished from existence. Broken and cathartically numb, I went downstairs. I grabbed one of the glasses left in the drying rack and watched the swirl of Blanton's as it accumulated an inch, two, three. I didn't taste it. I poured another. In time, the floorboards whimpered under the weight, and I heard its excruciating walk down the hall. The stairs crack with every awkward step, and when it hit the landing, it took its time to stare at me. It wants me to look away, so I don't. An abomination of horse and man, it crossed the kitchen with erratic steps, like its legs were broken. Despite the raw devastation of its build, it moved like a burden, every effort spent agitated, angry. When it lumbered through the light, I could see its clothing. A tattered three-piece suit, matched only by the wickedness of the patchwork skin beneath it. Its four legs were butchered, hooves replaced with human hands that looked too small at the end of its limbs. There was an odd elegance to the hands, and the way they stood out from the rage that was the rest of its body. It stopped on the other side of the table and towered over me. It begged me to look at it, its breath hot and racket, excited. The tears fell silently, and it gripped the glass in my hand. When it's satisfied, it knocked the chair away and sat on the floor across from me. The floor felt like it's going to give out. It cleared its throat and swallowed, organizing bits of flesh in its gullet before it spoke. When it does, it sounds like an old man being held underwater, the words coming in between gasps.
Forgive me. I usually let my meals marinate before I consume. But it's been a while since my last feast. There was so much misery. I found myself needing to save her.
It worked its lips, dragging on the last word, baring the incisors slowly. A single tooth fell from its maw and bounced onto the table. A molar. Olivia's.
Where's Emma?
I asked, and it watched as I downed my glass. Its eyes looked like polished obsidian. An ear twitched. Underneath the hide and muscle, something squirmed. Something worse, begging to be let out. The stitches on the hands stretch, bleed. I pour another.
What makes a person the person you know?
Lon's words. My skin chilled, and I shivered, looking to the glass for comfort. There's flies in it.
Why here?
My lip trembled as I asked, and the defiance in me cowers. I felt like I was freezing.
There's so much pain here. It's palpable, circular. Your delectable struggle called me here. Years ago, I nearly tasted the taste of your means, your anguish. It needed time to steep, to simmer. When it was ready, it called me again.
The horseman rested his forearms on the table in front of him, massaging the palms of his hands. A worn gold band stuck out one of the fingers. Lon's ring. Lon's hand.
But the children, they were just kids. and they didn't know. The horseman cut me off, leaning closer with each word.
You're a rot. Rudimentary. Weightless. Cattle.
I felt dizzy. Weightless. I looked down and saw blood, the stain growing in my shirt. I felt Olivia's hand on my cheek. When I touched it, the flies scatter. I was getting tired.
What is it you'd have me do?
I asked, and the horse scoffed. In a silent motion, it grabbed the bottle of bourbon with its mouth and reared it back, biting down. The glass exploded, and the shards and booze trickled down its throat. I could hear the grating as it was ground to powder. It struggled onto its hind legs afterwards and loomed over me, taking its time with every painful swallow. Its next words came through its teeth like a hiss. I closed my eyes as it taunted me from above. I didn't want to look at it. Not anymore.
Foolish. To think there'd be a purpose for you. I'm here merely to feed. And I'm afraid you're stale. But if you're feeling lost, there's always prayer.
The thud on the table reminded me I was trailing off. I looked to see the revolver, placed amongst the smattering of blood and glass and whiskey. The horse was gone. No stomping feet, no slam of the door. Just the wind under the wings of flies remained. I reached for the gun, pulling it toward me weakly. I opened the loading gate and rotated the cylinder, counting the brass caps as they turned. 5 empty shells, 1 round left. I spun it until it was next in line. The hammer echoed as I pulled it back, a ringing clarity against the buzzing of a broken mind. When the barrel entered my mouth, I wondered if Lon felt any of it. I wondered if the pain just went away. The doorbell chimed. I turned to look, peering down the hall and through the glass of the window in the door. There's no one standing there. Nobody is hiding or running away. There shouldn't have been.
Trick or treat.
I thought of a time where there were no flies, only happy laughter. A time when my brother used to smile ever so often, when the world hadn't dissolved his spark. A time he'd have a glimmer in his eye. I thought of him holding Emma as a baby, and that sparkle he had when he looked down upon her, swaddled, chubby, and content. I thought for a moment, maybe there was some light to be found amongst it all, a final miracle at the end of it all. From the kitchen table, the door unnerved me. I waited for another knock, another ring. Silence. I knew they were waiting, and I didn't want to keep them. I scooted out and made my way towards them. The gun came with me. Outside, it was bright. I stood in the doorway, leaning against it as I looked to the front lawn. I found what I'm looking for, 10 feet from the porch. Too far away for anyone to ring the doorbell.
Uncle Benny.
A gleeful lilt. The voice chilled me to the bone. The sheet the child was draped in was wet and dripping, collecting in a puddle at a pair of bare feet. There's no eyes cut out of the sheet to make it a proper costume. Just the vague shape of a girl where the fabric clings. It's just dark enough or heavy enough to not be sheer. I see nothing underneath.
Where did everyone go? A nice day for carving pumpkins.
The sheet didn't move when she talked. The little legs that poked from the bottom didn't fidget.
as the flies mill about them. Then from somewhere hidden hung the riveted straps of what looked like a bridle, a trail of reins leading behind her. At my side, the gun was heavy.
Uncle Benny?
She stood, motionless. The flies buzzed. One round.
Thank you for listening and delving with me into the dark together.
Please remember to leave a thumbs up and subscribe if you feel so inclined. The more engagement this video gets, the more YouTube will push my content to others.
Thus, the following will grow.
All stories read in this channel will be available on Spotify, iTunes, and just about everywhere else. Links in the description.
Thank you for listening and feeding the cause. We'll be seeing you.